You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I thought about asking Martin Amis to read from his latest novel, The Pregnant Widow, but I wasn't sure that he could find a passage that wouldn't violate the FCC's language rules. His new novel is about sex, and the sexual revolution is played out by a group of British 20-somethings vacationing in an Italian castle during the summer of 1970. Martin Amis has been hailed as one of the most brilliant writers of his generation. He's the author of a memoir, two collections of stories, 11 previous novels. This latest one is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Amis back to our show today. Hello.
Hi, nice to be here.
The book's protagonist is Keith Nearing, who arrives in Italy with his girlfriend Lily. Keith and Lily had broken up and had only recently gotten back together. They'd split up so she could, as she said, try to be a boy. How did that work for her?
Well, it is a work of fiction. It started as an autobiographical work until I realized belatedly that you can't write autobiographically about sex. The result is always disgusting, or at least embarrassing. But this was one of the strategies as the sexual revolution took hold. Really, a very convulsive time. And suddenly it was understood that they had these freedoms and that they were, in short, going to be promiscuous up to a point, up to their own personal tolerance levels.
In the same way that males often were.
Yeah. So there they were with these new freedoms, and they didn't have a model of how to behave. And the only model was the existing one, that of the boy. So it's, I think, called equalitarian feminism, this particular phase of it, where they behave like boys. I mean, that's the crux of the revolution, in my view, in that all the difficult choices, all the ticklish adaptations had to be made by the women. The boys just went on being boys, only it more so.
Are you giving the reader a hint right up front that there was a downside to the sexual revolution that's often overlooked?
Yeah. I mean, I think it was a great and wonderful and inevitable thing, simply because it multiplied opportunities, and that is what, you know, gives life its joy. But, of course, it was a bloodless revolution and a velvet revolution in at least two senses. But there were, of course, casualties. Either you couldn't quite join the sexual revolution because your inherited formulations to do with religion and saving yourself for your husband and all that was too strong in you, or the clever ones felt their way through it and found their own personal level of participation in the revolution, and the ones who overdid it. And the one autobiographical theme in this book is that of the sister. And my sister couldn't cope with these freedoms.
Well, throughout the story, Keith is carrying on a correspondent with his brother Nicholas in England, largely about their promiscuous younger sister Violet. You said that the character Nicholas was modeled in part on your old friend Christopher Hitchens, and that Violet is based in part on your younger sister, Sally, who died, 10 years ago after suffering from alcoholism and depression. So to some degree, is this a Romana Clay? Or?
No. I had to extract this novel from a much longer and horribly shapeless and lifeless autobiographical work.
Which has taken you a long time, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. Until I realized, I mean, it's a very peculiar quality of life when it's transferred to fiction. You find out that life is dead, that it has that it is utterly inert. And I think there's only ever been one novelist who could take life and fill it with meaning and pattern, and that was Saul Bellow, because most novelists search for the universal and make up characters that represent various themes. he seemed to do it the other way round, where he stared with such visionary force into individuals that he could generalize from that.
Although he was very proud of the fact that he had never been to Africa before he wrote Henderson the Rain King.
Oh, no, I mean, he's there are varying intensities of autobiography, and Henderson the Rain King is, you know, a tour de force of the imagination. But he was the only one, I think, who ever got anywhere with it. I had to face up to the fact that I couldn't do it that way. What gives a novel life usually is pattern and symmetry, which life just doesn't provide.
Might things have turned out differently for your sister Sally if she had been born 50 or 100 years earlier?
Unquestionably.
Before the sexual revolution?
Yes. And she might have survived the sexual revolution. There's a mild, conciliatory Islamic theme in this novel, which is there because only in such a conservative, strictly monitored society could my sister have made it, I think. She would have struggled in almost every kind of society. But if she converted to Islam and not to Catholicism, which is what she did, she might be alive today.
After they arrive in Italy, Keith almost immediately falls for Lily's friend, Scheherazade, a gorgeous blonde who likes to sunbathe topless, and you've even included her measurements. Why give her the name, the same name as a Parisian queen who saved her own life by telling 1,001 stories? Your novel, Scheherazade, doesn't tell stories.
She does. She tells a story about sexual disgrace, which Keith asks her to prolong. That's the single glance at her. But I chose the name for euphony. I don't think names should be symbolic, and they shouldn't be joke names. But since you're going to be typing that word a couple of hundred times, it should have resonance.
Well, the names sometimes have humorous connotations. Keith nearing somebody who's always nearing some sense of completion. But actually, the setting of this book reminded me more of another book of collected stories, Boccaccio's Decameron, or perhaps one of Shakespeare's plays where everyone winds up mixing and matching in a forest.
Yes, it's more like Boccaccio in that it's a la ronde of episodes. But it doesn't quite have the sunniness of the Shakespearean comedy, where, you know, as you know, the pattern is that some young people come up against an interdiction imposed by the older generation, and this they overcome, usually in a green setting, and then at the end there's a kind of festive conclusion, and absolutely everyone gets married. But these conventions don't quite hold.
Although your characters are also fighting in what they would see as an interdiction of the older generation.
Well, except the interdiction had sort of mysteriously evaporated. And I'm convinced that all my friends, my male friends, were having great battles with their fathers at this time. I didn't have it with mine because he'd already had that battle with his father. He was very evolved in that sense.
Well, your father's the famous writer Kingsley Amis.
Yeah.
Who also wrote funny books about sex at times.
He did. But the reason the fathers were furious is that, the first rule that was broken by the sexual revolution was there will be no sex before marriage. And then the fathers were suddenly thinking, what's all this about there now being sex before marriage? And they envied their sons.
My guest is Martin Amis. His latest novel is The Pregnant Widow, which is published by Knopf. You begin your first chapter by citing Philip Larkin's famous lines. Sexual intercourse began in 1963, which was rather late for me, between the end of the Chatterley Band and the LP's first LP. The Beatles' first LP. A very witty line, and it kind of suggests that the previous generation did feel left out until there was a dripping down to them as well.
Yeah. I think he got the date wrong, by the way. I think it was 1966. There wasn't any sexual intercourse until then.
Maybe for Philip Larkin it was 1963.
well, look, the great theme in Larkin's poems is that that the new freedom is illusory, and that that you think that you envy the young, but the old envied you when you were young, and it all looked like a marvelous strategy for happiness, and then in fact it's, you know, you come across the same difficulties. I mean, that's the way his generation would see it.
Can we talk about naming for a moment? You've taken the title of your book from a phrase from Alexander Herzen.
Yes, he says that we should welcome revolutions of either of cultural or political values. But he says, but what is frightening is that the departing world leaves behind it not an heir or an inheritor, but a pregnant widow. And between the death of the one and the birth of the other, a long night of chaos and desolation will pass, which I think is an exquisite insight into what a revolution is. You think it's a capsizal and a flip, but in fact it's a deep process that has to thread its way through you. And I think, for instance, the rise of women, which is also what this book is about, will take, you know, at least another century before it settles.
Herzen was kind of the hero of Tom Stoppard's The Coast of Utopia. Keith, as I said, his last name is Nearing. He never seems to get what he wants. You have another woman in the party who is apparently attractive rear end, called Gloria Beauty Man. But this is the third time you've named a major character of one of your books, Keith. One reviewer remarked that it is never a good thing to be named Keith in a Martin Amis novel. I guess he was thinking about Keith Tallant, the villain in London Fields, for example.
There are other unfortunate Keiths. Well, I wasn't going to call him Keith, and then I just couldn't find a name for him, and none of them sounded right. And then I came up across the Kafka theme, you know, the castle, and whose main character is K. Mm-hmm. So I thought he's got to be a K in the castle. And then I thought, to hell with it, I'll call him Keith.
Again.
Yeah.
Keith hopes to become a writer, and he's trying to read through the canon of English literature, D.H. Lawrence, George Eliot, Shakespeare, Jane Austen. He even suggests that Pride and Prejudice could have been improved if Jane Austen had only added a 40-page sex scene near the end. And you've cited Jane Austen as one of your earliest influences. How do you think that she'd react to your suggestion if she were alive today?
Well, they had different ways of writing about sex in the 19th century. In Dickens, Louisa Gradgrind says, who's about to marry an old man at her father's prompting, says, "Have you seen the smokestacks outside, Father? At night, flames come from them." And the father says, "I do not understand that remark." Mm-hmm. And in George Eliot...
Which was a signal to the reader that...
Well, to the modern
reader.
We
could understand that remark.
Yeah, we could. And in George Eliot, Dorothea goes to see the paintings in Florence, and someone says, "How do you respond to them?" She said, "They frighten me." You know, these are ways of writing about sex. And then Lawrence is, of course, the pivotal figure, and then suddenly it's out in the open.
And he's banned for a while, at least in America. Do you believe that Austen was actually using coded language to describe her characters' breasts and derrières, maybe even sexual trysts, as Keith and his friends guessed that she was?
I think her one really physical heroine is Elizabeth Bennet, and it's she is sexually very powerful on the page. And there's that extraordinary passage towards the end when her father says, "Lizzie, you mustn't marry Mr. Darcy if it's a prudential marriage. I know your lively tenets. You would be neither happy nor respectable in a loveless marriage." And there's nothing like that, meaning she would become adulterous. And she has these sort of burning teeth and flushing face, and she is the one sexual creature in Jane Austen. So there were ways of doing it.
There have been mixed reviews in the New York Magazine. Sam Anderson called this a nearly perfect comic novel, and he says it's your best book in 15 years. Others have loved it. But you can never get past Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times.
No. I sometimes get pasta. But I don't think anyone who reads the New York Times and reads fiction is going to be much swayed by her anymore.
Do you read your own reviews?
I glance at them because you don't want the phrases in your head. And even a nice review will more often than not say something that will jar with you.
I once had an art teacher who said that we should go to shows and note the works that elicited the most positive responses from us and the most negative responses and ignore all the rest. And when we made up lists, it turns out that the same names appeared on negative and positive on most of the lists. And he said, well, these are the most important artists of our time.
I think one shouldn't be, as Norma Mailer put it, one shouldn't be understood too quickly. And if you're met with a kind of stupor satisfaction from every reviewer, then I think you're not doing enough.
Martin Amis's latest novel is The Pregnant Widow. It is published by Knopf. When will I be seeing you again? You have another book in the works?
I have another book nearly finished. So I'm having as I go into my 60s, I'm having misleadingly energetic time.
Well, let's hope that this one takes less time than The Pregnant Widow did. 15 years or so?
No, it was I started about 10 years ago and put it aside and wrote another novel, House of Meetings, and was doing other things. But it was a wrong turning, and it took me a long time to see I was lost.
Thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure.
Thank you.